and their children's lives, and the power and the courage it takes to do so against all odds. So I encourage you to go to our archive, WGTD.org, and listen to the full show. I'm Troy McDonald. Thank you for spending a part of your Saturday morning here with us. We'll see you next time on Generation Now.
This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW-Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Manji. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown. I'm very pleased to welcome as my guest this morning, John Tinker. And we will be talking about the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case of Tinker versus Des Moines. And in 2019, it will be celebrating the 50th anniversary. School officials are often confronted with difficult decisions when students' attempts at expression result in disorder or the potential disruption of regular school activities. And this landmark U.S. Supreme Court case establishing the free speech and political rights of students in school settings is Tinker versus Des Moines. And that case was decided in February of 1969 and will be celebrating the 50th anniversary throughout 2019. And we'll be talking with John about that. Also, this program is airing on November the 10th of 2018. And it's almost 50 years to the day that the oral arguments were held in the U.S. Supreme Court on November the 12th of 1968. John Tinker, welcome once again to Education Matters.
Hey, great to be with you, Steve.
As we talk about the case and talk about all the things involving the case, you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about over the years, and I should say for our listening audience that for purposes of transparency, John and I have worked together for at least 20 years now, with John appearing in my school law classes at Northeastern Illinois University, Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi, and most recently at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. So John and I have worked together, and we'll talk about the Tinker Foundation a bit later. But, you know, John, one of the things that you and I have talked about, and in fact it was one of our presentations, I think it was 2 years ago, for the Wisconsin School Board Association, the title was, Is Free Speech Still Free Today? And I thought we would just kind of start with that discussion and then lead back into a discussion about the court case. But as you look at where things are right now in 2018, students getting more involved in activities, speaking their mind, whether it's after the terrible school shootings down in Florida, in Parkland, Florida, or whatever the situations might be, do you think right now that free speech is still free today, in particular for our public school students?
Well, I do think that free speech is still free today. Sometimes speech and the constraints on speech are not coming from as much as they're coming from just people's fear of speaking their mind. But in terms of the courts, I believe that free speech is still free.
And let's go back to 1965, if we could, and maybe talk about what led up to you and your sister Mary Beth and others, including Christopher Eckhart, who passed away a few years ago. What prompted the group of you to actually wear black armbands as a way of showing your feelings about the war in Vietnam?
By December of 1965, there was a growing awareness of what was that included some of us kids in Iowa. My parents were very active in the anti-war movement, and so we had a lot of information about the war. My father was, his job title was Peace Education Secretary. He worked for a Quaker organization. And we had information about what was going on in Vietnam, and it seemed tragic to us. So there was a large demonstration in Washington the end of 1965, and some of us went to that demonstration. On the bus ride back, we were discussing what we could do to continue to protest against the war and to encourage all parties involved to seek a peaceful resolution. And so it came up on that bus ride that some people would be wearing armbands, and maybe we should do that too. And it seemed like a good idea because it was an old symbol of mourning. It wasn't an accusation of any kind, and it was silent. It was not in the face, and it seemed like a good kind of what you might call a witness to your opposition to the war. So we decided to wear the black armbands.
Maybe describe, if you could, the experience of being in Washington, D.C. for that march. With regards to what that was like for you. You were 15 years old at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Describe what it was like for you to be in Washington, D.C. and to hear the speeches and if, in fact, you heard Senator Kennedy speak and others, what impact that had on you personally, as a 15-year-old?
Well, that was the first time also I had been to Washington, D.C., and honestly, I hadn't been to many big cities. I really didn't understand what a big city was. In a way, Des Moines is a kind of a smaller city.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was impressed by all of the federal architecture, the solidity of the buildings, and the obvious expense of creating them. I mean, it was an impressive kind of a tourist trip in a sense also, but beyond that, the speeches and the crowd, the size of the crowd, to be in a large group of people among people who disagreed with the U.S. policy in Vietnam as I did, it was pretty significant for me to be no longer the isolated outcast in the sense with the minority opinion.
Sure.
Even though I had friends in Des Moines that agreed with me, it was still a very much a minority opinion. And to be amongst the crowd in Washington, D.C., and to realize that a lot of people were against the war,
mm-hmm.
it just boosted my confidence that that we were on the right track and that we might be able to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was a very stimulating experience for me.
John, were you an outgoing student in high school? If you had to describe John Tinker back in 1963, 64, 65, 66, if you will, how would you describe John at that time?
Well, it was not especially outgoing, but I wasn't either especially a reserved, quiet, inward-looking person. I was social to a degree. I had a number of friends. Academically, I was a good student. I was a National Merit Scholarship honorable mention.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't quite make it, but I don't know what to say. I was a preacher's kid. My siblings and I all grew up as preacher's kids.
Tell us a bit about Reverend Leonard Tinker and your mother, Lenora Jean, as far as what life was like in the family and their involvement and support that they gave you during these times, and even before you went to Washington, in terms of what kinds of discussions you had around the, you know, the kitchen table at dinner about the war in Vietnam, or just, you know, current affairs?
Well, my parents were both very active in social issues. They had been active in the civil rights movement. My father was a believer in the social gospel. His project was to help bring the kingdom of heaven to earth. And so in a sense, he was an idealist. He was a Christian believer. And we often talked about world affairs, about social issues around the dinner table. It was normal for us to be involved in relatively serious discussions about serious matters. And I guess our family was unusual in that way, maybe, for where we were, but I didn't realize that exactly at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they were both very concerned, intelligent, knowledgeable people.
Mm-hmm. After you and the others got back from Washington, D.C., after the event there, you know, the march and asking for, you know, a Christmas peace, if you will, or a truce, what kinds of discussions did you have with friends, with family, with others that led up to the decision to actually wear those black armbands?
It was mostly, we knew that we wanted to continue protesting the war, and more than just protesting, we wanted to help bring awareness of the war to the citizens. We wanted to help educate people about what was going on in Vietnam, and we hoped to stimulate opposition to what was happening there. So we talked about all those issues. We talked about nonviolence. The nonviolent part of the peace movement was related to the nonviolence of the civil rights movement and Dr. King and his commitment to nonviolence. That had transferred also over to the anti-war movement. And so there were discussions about tactics and what would be beneficial and what could harm our movement. So we talked about how we were going to go about raising awareness about the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, at what point did this information get out to others, and in particular to administrators and maybe school board members? And as our listening audience knows, I'm a member of a local school board in Western Kenosha County. I've been a high school teacher and a high school principal. But how did all this information at some point leak out to the public, and specifically to anyone in the school district that led up to what happened on December 15th and 16th in terms of the suspensions, which we'll talk more about in a few minutes?
Well, one of our group of students wrote an article for his school newspaper describing what we were going to do and why we were doing it. And so when he submitted his article to the faculty advisor of the newspaper, the advisor, I guess, was shocked, and he contacted the principal of that high school, and that principal got a hold of the principals of the other high schools in Des Moines, and they decided to have a meeting to discuss that. And at that meeting, they decided to not permit the wearing of armbands.
Yeah, and those principals met, and I'm just reading some of the background that's in the that's part of the court opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court, that those principals met, and they learned of the plan, and they met on December 14th, which was literally 24 hours, 48 hours, if you will, before you and Mary Beth and Hope and Paul and Chris Eckhart decided to actually wear the black armbands. And I want to talk more about those specific events on those days. But they developed a policy after hearing that you were going to be wearing black armbands, correct?
Yeah, that's right. They learned about it from us. And we learned about their decision from the newspaper.
So there was no policy in place at that point. There was nothing that said students can't wear black armbands. Students can't wear offensive necklaces or T-shirts or anything that would offend anyone. At that point, there were no policies in place. Is that correct?
Well, in a sense, there were policies in place, but the policy in place was that all of that was permitted.
Oh.
We wore campaign buttons and...
Really?
Yeah.
One of the things I know that is mentioned in the oral arguments, and speaking of the oral arguments, we're going to play a clip in a moment with Dan Johnston, who represented you, and also Abe Fortas, who ended up writing the majority opinion. Briefly talk about the wearing of iron crosses that some students wore, what it represented, what it could have represented, and how that sort of played a part in all this.
Right. Well, the iron cross, or sometimes it's called the Prussian iron cross, was a German symbol, even before the Nazis. It was, I don't know what it represented actually, but
sure,
it was a very German symbol. For some reason, it was adopted by the teen culture as a surfer cross.
Right, yeah.
And so when the kids were wearing it, it didn't have any political overtone at all. It was just a thing. They called it a surfer cross.
John, when the principals made this decision on December 14th to create the policy, what occurred after that in terms of you and the others actually wearing the black armbands, knowing that there was this policy in place?
Well, for a day, we kind of walked around stunned a little bit. We weren't expecting that. We were expecting to be nervous about presenting our views about the war to the other students and the teachers. We were kind of anticipating that sort of discomfort, but to suddenly be faced with a rule just prohibiting what we were planning to do, we had no expectation that that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so really for a day we were just kind of stunned. We mentioned the fact, but we didn't actually plan around it what to do, and that's why at the last minute I thought, well, we really should, and I tried to kind of call it off for a day so we'd have a chance to talk about it among the students and kind of come up with a concerted plan. What were we going to do? Mary Beth had already gone to school while I was finishing up my paper route, and Chris, when I called him, he said, "I don't care, I'm going to wear it anyway." But that's basically, nothing really happened, and something should have happened. That was my realization kind of at the last minute that we should have been discussing this. And
the school principals make this policy on December 14th, and 2 days later, on the 16th of December, so this is right before what was called then the Christmas holiday, and now it's the winter holiday, or whatever people call it nowadays. So here's where Mary Beth and Chris Eckhart wore the black armbands 2 days later. So what exactly happened to Mary Beth and Chris on that day, on the 16th of December of 1965?
Well, Chris went to school, and he marched himself directly to the office and turned himself in. He knew that it was against the rules what he was doing, and so he said he turned himself in. and then he was suspended. They called his mother to try to get her to persuade him not to wear it. Mm-hmm. She was completely a peace activist herself, and she very much supported the wearing of the armbands. Mary Beth went to school and went to some classes. I'm not sure which class it was that where she finally got sent to the office by Mr. Moberly.
Right, and he was her math teacher, correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he had warned, he had heard about it too from the newspaper and the ban on wearing the armbands. Mm. And so he was aware of it, and he had warned his students not to dare do such a thing. And so he was upset that Mary Beth had worn the armband anyway, and he sent her to the office.
Mm-hmm.
And at the office, she was intimidated, basically, and told to take it off. And so she did. And she was sent back to class then. But later they had second thoughts about just sending her back to class. She thought that they thought that she needed to be punished also. And so at that point they suspended her.
So that was after she was called to the office. She took the armband off. She goes back to class. And then that afternoon she's called back to the office and suspended when she's not wearing the armband. And because they wanted to follow the policy. And yet your younger siblings, Hope, who at the time was 11, Paul, who was 8 at the time, they wore black armbands, and nothing happened to them, right? There was no action taken at all with them?
Right. Now, technically, the ruling only applied to the secondary schools. I'm not actually sure it applied to Mary Beth's situation, but the grade school teachers felt that it didn't apply to them.
Oh.
And so they just didn't make any big deal of Hope and Paul wearing the armbands.
If you're just joining us here on Education Matters this morning, my guest is John Tinker, and we are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court case of Tinker versus Des Moines, which will be celebrating its 50th anniversary during 2019, and this case deals with the issue of free speech and the First Amendment. John, let's listen briefly to a clip. This is Abe Fortas, who was an associate justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He was appointed by Lyndon Johnson a few years earlier, and then he later, of course, wrote the majority opinion, which we'll talk about briefly a bit later. And then also your attorney, Dan Johnson. So let's listen briefly to this audio clip, and then on the other side we'll talk about it, okay?
Okay.
Does it matter what the expression is about? Suppose some child shows up at school wearing an outlandish costume. I don't want to particularize it. And that's in violation of a regulation of the school saying that children must come to school decently clothed. And this child says that I'm wearing this outlandish costume because I want to express a very strong belief that I have in the utmost freedom for the individual. You know, Kool-Aid and electronic test kit and all the things that are being written about these days. So this child says that's what I want to do. Does that make any difference? Does he have a constitutionally protected right with respect to that kind of expression, or would you limit it to matters of social and political importance, societal importance?
Justice Fortas, I believe that the real question in that regard hinges upon whether or not the utterance is expression as contemplated by the First Amendment, which was a finding that the district court made, as a matter of fact, that students were engaged in expression of views privileged by the First Amendment unless it's subordinated by some other state interest.
So, John, when you hear that, I guess I have two questions. What is your reaction as you hear that now in terms of Justice Fortas making his comment and the comments from Dan Johnston, who passed away several years ago, as far as how he related the black armband and freedom of expression?
Well, I think that Dan got it just right. I think it's a fair question. I would correct Justice Fortas on the electric Kool-Aid acid test. I think that's right. I think it's realizing that speech, communication of ideas, is not all that we use our voices for.
Mm-hmm.
Like a bank robber might use his voice to say your money or your life or something like that. It's not sort of like all speech is not the same. And society has determined that not everything goes.
Or if a student wore a T-shirt like Brett Barber did in Michigan with a picture of George W. Bush and saying he's an international terrorist, right?
Right. Well, now that is an idea, and it's the expression of a political view.
Mm-hmm.
I think that not only political views should be protected, but I do think that that there are some expressions that should not be protected. And I'm not talking about a symbolic expression per se, but just maybe we're not aware of how many rules we have in society, but we have quite a few that make society work. And it used to be that children should be seen and not heard was mm-hmm. one of the rules. And that's basically the rule that that our case is coming up against, the idea that that children are lesser beings and that in our society they should be relegated to a lesser status. That was where we came from.
Sure.
And in our case, the society as a whole, in the guise of our Supreme Court, has ruled that no, children, first off, they're citizens,
mm-hmm.
and they have their constitutional rights, and restrictions on those rights have to be constrained. The restrictions have to be constrained to only have restrictions that serve an actual goal, a purpose, a legitimate pedagogical purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, keeping us from expressing an opposition to the war in Vietnam was not a legitimate pedagogical purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, because of the 1943 Barnett
right.
Case.
Right, and for our audience, that dealt with a Pledge of Allegiance, right?
Yes, the Jehovah's Witnesses
right. yes.
didn't want to recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right.
And that case came during World War II,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
when, as a nation, we were fighting a fascist regime. And so the court at that point realized that we don't win over fascism by becoming fascist ourselves. It's we win by being democratic and sharing our ideas with each other and allowing each other to express their ideas. And so our case is on that line of really liberating the youth in a certain fashion to the extent of allowing them to say what they think. It's not. The pedagogical interest is still primary, and the society's ability to teach its young is primary. And so, the expression of the student cannot be detrimental to the pedagogical purpose.
Sure, John. Let's listen briefly to this exchange between then Chief Justice Earl Warren and Dan Johnston, who represented you.
The situation here, as I view it, is based not so much upon the conduct of the students, whether or not it was permissible, but the conduct of the state, whether or not the conduct of the state was permissible. Whether or not where we have a situation of pure expression and nothing else, which with no evidence of any material or substantial disruption of any public interest, whether or not in that situation the state can move to subordinate and to punish freedom of expression.
Why isn't this case moot?
Case is not moot.
Nobody's been punished, have they? I'm reading from your brief at the bottom of page 8, top of page 9, showing that the petitioners returned to school at the end of the Christmas vacation, January 4th or 5th, 1966. That's 2.5 years ago, 2.75 years ago. Without their armbands, and as far as appears, that's the end of it. They weren't punished for it.
Your Honor, the students each testified in the district court, and this will appear in the record, that although they did return to school because of the obvious dire consequences to themselves if they did not return to school, that they still have these views on the war in Vietnam, they still have the desire to wear armbands to express their opposition to the war in Vietnam, and were the policy taken away, they would wear their armbands to school.
So, John, before we talk about the actual court decision, you know, the key point there that Dan Johnson was talking about was that the wearing of that black armband, when you wore it and when Mary Beth wore it, and, of course, Chris never wore it into classes because he went right to the office and presented himself and turned himself in, is this whole idea of a material and substantial disruption. And that's also, there's always a question about, you know, that's sort of vague, too. Like, how do you know it would cause a material and substantial disruption? There were no disruptions, per se, at school with you wearing that black armband, correct?
Correct. We did have a discussion. There were events that came with it, but there was no physical altercation mm-hmm. or anything like mm-hmm. that.
And John, before we look at the court decision, when you returned to school on January 3rd or 4th and you were no longer wearing the black armband, what did you wear for the rest of the school year?
Well, I decided to wear all black clothing until the end of the year, and so that's what I did, and I have to say everybody knew exactly why I was doing
it. Of course. I mean, that sent a very clear, if you will, a very clear and present and substantial message, didn't it?
I think so.
The final court decision, by the way, was 7-2 in your favor. In the final decision, the court observed, it can hardly be argued that either students or teachers shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate. Abe Fortas wrote the majority opinion holding that the speech regulation at issue in Tinker was based upon an urgent wish to avoid the controversy which might result from the expression, even by the silent symbol of armbands, of opposition to this nation's part in the Vietnam War. The court held that for school officials to justify censoring speech, they must be able to show that their action was caused by something more than a mere desire to avoid the discomfort and unpleasantness that always accompany an unpopular viewpoint. So, you know, if we can go back to that first question I asked you 41 minutes ago, is free speech still free today? And tie that back into this idea of whether or not something that someone says might cause discomfort or might be unpleasant, that in and of itself does not necessarily, John, actually create a material and substantial disruption, does it?
No. One other, I want to make a point first that
sure.
Teachers actually have less free speech rights in the schools than the students, in my view, because
mm-hmm.
Teachers are also subject to the terms of their contract.
Right.
And they're employees of the school. And and in that relationship, the school can decide what teachers can or cannot express opinions about.
Sure. So, John, I agree with you. And the part with teachers, by the way, the one area that they are not allowed to express their opinions and get involved in any discussions with students, a blanket comment I'll make, is in the area of religion, because of the ideas of separation of church and state. But including teachers, though, I thought was a very interesting piece, and people think that that goes back to the Pickering decision about 9 months before, and that was Mark Pickering, who was a teacher down in the South Chicago area, who wrote letters to the editor expressing his points of view, and he was writing as a private citizen. But John, you know, one last thing I wanted to mention to you, and that is that Justice Hugo Black was really concerned that your decision, that the Tinker decision, was going to turn over the power of the public schools into the hands of students. And when you read that, and when you hear people talk about that, what's your reaction?
Well, it's a scare tactic. It's a fear mongering, is my opinion. The material and substantial disruption clause. That's really an important point, because Abe Fortas points out that, as you quoted, that a contentious argument is always going to cause discomfort. And the sort of the old rule was, if the administrator was uncomfortable, then they could do whatever they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And the enlightened democratic with a small d point of view is that the discomfort is just part of the political system that we've chosen upon. If we want to have a democracy, then we're not going to all speak with one voice, and there's going to be contention. And that's part of who we are, and it's the playing out of those tensions and the working out of our disagreements that makes our society vital.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a recognition, at least by the justices of the Supreme Court, that this is true. And Abe Fortas rallied language from prior court decisions and amplified it and made it into a whole cloth about the nature of freedom of speech. And he articulated it very well, I think, in his opinion, in our case.
John, in closing, as we talked about at the beginning, this U.S. Supreme Court decision was decided on February 24th of 1969, and you will be celebrating the 50th anniversary all throughout 2019 and beyond. You know, it'll be the 51st anniversary and the 55th and so forth after 2019. But tell us briefly about the John F. Tinker Foundation that's been recently created and what the purpose of that foundation is.
The John F. Tinker Foundation is dedicated to educating the students and teachers and administrators of America what the law is, what the law of the land is, and about our case in particular. We're also interested in encouraging civic dialogue generally. We believe that it's very important that people with differing viewpoints continue to communicate and to try to work it out. And so it's a kind of a two-pronged mission. The first one being educational regarding our case and the implications, and the other cases that kind of go together as a constellation around it, but also to encourage the conversation and to try to encourage people to actually articulate their thoughts and to learn to listen to opinions that they disagree with.
I look forward to activities of the Tinker Foundation. I wanted to thank you, as always, being my guest here on Education Matters. And I wanted to close with a quote here from Thomas Emerson with regards to freedom of expression. And he said, "The attainment of freedom of expression is not the sole aim of the good society. As the private right of the individual, freedom of expression is an end of itself, but it is not the only end of man or persons as individuals. Any theory of freedom of expression must therefore take into account other values such as public order, justice, equality, and moral progress, and the need for substantive measures designed to promote those ideals. Hence, there is a problem of reconciling freedom of expression with the other values and objectives sought by the good society." And when I read this, and this, by the way, is in the 8th edition of the American Public School Law Book by Kern Alexander and M. David Alexander, a book that I use in my school law class. We have a society where free speech is very important. The First Amendment is very important. And John, the Tinker decision after 50 years is still the most important First Amendment decision about freedom of speech and freedom of expression that the U.S. Supreme Court has made, certainly in the 20th century, and it carries forward into the 21st century. And I just want to thank you, along with your sister Mary Beth, and everyone who's been involved over the years with regards to making sure that all of us understand, support, and carry out our responsibilities under the First Amendment.
Well, thank you, Steve, for those words. And I want to thank you also for your passion for student rights and academic freedom and freedom of speech. I think that I really welcome your efforts and your participation in the Tinker Foundation, and I just want to thank you very much for doing what you do.
Well, I appreciate that, John. My guest this morning here on Education Matters has been John Tinker, whose U.S. Supreme Court case of Tinker versus Des Moines, which was decided by the United States Supreme Court on February 24th of 1969, still remains the quintessential case dealing with the First Amendment rights of free speech for students and teachers. For Education Matters, here on WGTD HD, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Captain John Litherland, as commanding officer of the USS Texas, newest of the Virginia-class submarines, I invite you to listen to Deep Stealth on WGTD-FM.
And a very pleasant good morning. This is Steve Brown, co-executive producer and co-writer of the WGTD Radio Theater, inviting you to join the 91.1 players as they perform Deep Stealth, written by Mike Ostrup and myself. And we are performing live from Lake Lawn Resort on beautiful Lake Delavan in Delavan, Wisconsin. This is show number 117 in this, our 14th season. We began today's program with a greeting from Captain John Litherland, commander of the USS Texas, which is a Virginia-class submarine and the fourth warship of the United States Navy to be renamed after the state of Texas. She was christened on 31 July of 2004 by Laura Bush, then First Lady of the United States.